Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For almost 40 years, Chris Katz has been a familiar face on TV right here in Kansas City. In fact, for all of those years, he's been with Channel 9. There was a couple of times during Katz's career where he went, "Whoa, I don't know what's going on here. I need to get out of this situation." We'll discuss those. Plus, when a news person actually becomes the news. It's something you're not supposed to do, but there was one fateful night where Chris Katz became the story.
Well, how about that? 37 years, my friend, at Channel 9 just passed on July 4th. And as we sit here in 2020, did you ever think you'd be anchoring news at a time where we have race riots, we have weather issues going on right now, we have economy issues, we have virus issues? Like, it's all converging into one, huh?
I wouldn't, when I walked into KNBC on the 4th of July, 1983, I wouldn't have given myself much of a chance to last 2 years, much less 37. No.
Why wouldn't you have given yourself an opportunity to last that long?
Oh, because I was, Bob, I was a kid in his early 20s with hardly any experience in the business at all. Moving from market what was then, I don't know, 75 or 80 in the Quad Cities to market what was, I think at the time, 29 in Kansas City. That kind of a market jump was not something that was typical of the time. It's much more today, but not in 1983. And when I walked into that newsroom for the first time, I will always give myself credit for this. I had at least a partial sense of what I didn't know about where I was and what the job I was hired for. There was so much about reporting that coming from the Quad Cities to a big market like Kansas City, I didn't know. And so I walk into this newsroom, and it didn't take me long to figure out that I was in way, way, way over my head. But I will give myself credit for this. I was at least smart enough at that time to realize that I was in a room with some awfully talented people. And if I just kept my mouth shut and watched how they worked, I might learn something. I was in a newsroom. To my left was Michael Mahoney, who, for my money, he's as good as it gets. To my right was the late, great Edward Lewis. Two seats down to the left next to Mahoney was Bob Worley. And about 3 or 4 months later, Bev Chapman walks in, who has been retired from KNBC for many years now, but for my money, again, one of the best ever. I've said for years, if I could be half as good a writer as Bev Chapman, I would have died and I'll have died and gone to heaven. She's just that good. So I'm in a room with some seasoned professionals who know what they're doing and who are really good at what they do. Why am I here? This makes no sense at all. So, but 37 years later, I, if nothing else, you can say he hasn't had trouble keeping a job, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. So after that 37 years, or after that first day, I should say, what was that the first day you went to the coif, or did that come after day two? Or when did you start, you know, attending what was the real place where business got done for Channel 9?
Bob Fesco's done his homework. you know, it was Mahoney who introduced me to the coif. And of course, Michael had been here a few years and was, I think in 1983, he was a hard news reporter, but he came here as a features guy and obviously had a head start on Kansas City and was able to introduce me to some of the more popular establishments downtown at the time. And certainly the Coif was at the top of the list. So it didn't take long for me to realize where the Coif was and its significance in downtown. And of course, it's legendary. 1010 Broadway. Say hi to the Bonino family when you walk in because they're just terrific.
Well, I think as a journalist, you have to, you know, get your sources from everywhere. I know in sports, man, we hear from a lot of people, the real estate agent, the guy at the airport, you know, people like that, the cab driver and whatnot. But I can always say, like, the bartender knows what's going on in a town. Like, those guys know everything. And a friend of mine's in city government, not in this area, and he says to me, he goes, the more that I live here, the more I realize the bartenders and the waiters, those are the ones who know everything that's going on in town.
And the Coif then and now was a place that drew people from all walks of society. You could be a big-time development lawyer working on some big real estate deal downtown. Chances are you are going to be at the Coif. You could be a major market legendary television anchor like Larry Moore, for instance. Not unusual to see Larry at the Coif after a broadcast. It was certainly a place to hang out for us, for someone like myself who worked many years on the night side. That was a place that we would go to unwind. Part of it was close. Don't forget, we were in the Lyric Theater for so many years at 11th and Central. And so you walk out the front door and you turn right a couple of steps and through the alley and there you are. But it's such a wonderful place. And I'm so glad you brought it up because it gives me a chance to brag about them a little bit and tell them how much, they mean to so many people, especially at Channel 9. Because for many, many years, before we moved out to the Far East Side, there was a running joke that the Coif was kind of Channel 9 West. and for so many years, it certainly was.
Well, it's interesting, though, because when I was in college and we took I think it was either journalism law or journalism history, whatever it was, Tom Volek was the teacher. And I remember him telling us, and I'll always remember this, booze and journalism. Bars were the first form of journalism in this country. Everybody gathered, everybody talked about the, you know, the stories of the day and everything that was going on. He goes, and that's still true to this day. And that was in the 1990s. And, you know, here you are, and everybody knows Channel 9, how legendary that place was. How many story ideas, things did you get by sitting around that place?
I lost count 30 years ago. Again, a function of the fact that so many people from so many walks of life in Kansas City would spend some of their downtime in there. And lawyers, you name it, business executives, again, you name it. There were all kinds of people there and they all had stories to tell. And more times than not, they were really good stories to tell. And yeah, I picked up a ton of leads from there. As a television station, when we moved out east, there are many of us who have been around for a long time. Michael may be more the exception than the rule, but there are some of us who have been at KNBC for a long time who probably have lost a little track with the Coif just because we're so far removed from it now geographically. And there really aren't a lot of places to hang out where we are at 435 and 63rd. There isn't a Coif across the street to go to hang out, to unwind from a day's work. And that's a regret of mine. Quite frankly, it is such a terrific place and the people who run it are wonderful. And it's one of the things that I miss about being downtown. I know that when we were looking to build a new building, we tried really hard for a site downtown, and for a variety of reasons, it just didn't work. Not to say that where we are right now isn't terrific. It is. It's much easier to get to from where I live now than our studio downtown. But I do miss downtown. I miss it a lot. When we made the move out east, there were a lot of things in the pipeline, but they hadn't quite happened yet. And when we moved, you had a feeling that we might find ourselves saying years later, boy, I wish we were still downtown, because it's really a happening place.
So you said when we started, you didn't think you'd last all of 2 years. Here it is, 37 years. You know, what about Kansas City kept you here 35 years plus longer than you ever thought you'd be here?
Oh, I think my father was somebody who was an anchor up in the Quad Cities for 35 years before he passed away in 1999, and he had opportunities to move. Part of it was that he had three young sons, and I think the idea of picking up and moving was not something that was terribly appealing to him, the hassle of moving and reestablishing roots and that sort of thing. I also think, too, that my dad was somebody who had a pretty good sense. He liked where he was. He knew it was a really good place to raise a family. And why give that up? Why take a chance on something that is unknown? I'm probably a little bit like that. The thought of moving has never been terribly appealing to me. And the opportunities to go other places that have come, I just never thought the opportunities were appealing, but I just never thought that they were long-term better than where I was. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I just never thought that the upside was so much that I wanted to take a chance on that. And so I've had it pretty good here at KNBC for an awfully long time. And I'm still one of those people who it's still a lot of fun to go to work. And I say that after being there 37 years and in daily journalism now pushing 42. Not a lot of people can say that. And I know I'm incredibly lucky to be able to do so. So I guess part of it is for me to answer your question. I don't like moving. I like where I'm at. This has been a wonderful place to raise a family, as we are still doing. Why give that up?
Is there one that you look at and you go, man, I wish I would have given that one an opportunity maybe? Do you have like a regret of a job? Or because I think when we're all in this business, you know, you mentioned 2 years here. I never thought I'd be back in Kansas City, let alone back for a decade. You always thought you'd move on and someplace else. There's just something about this town that keeps you here, that makes you want to be here. Is there any one offer where you look at and you go, man, I wish I would have taken a chance on that?
I was in some very, very preliminary discussions with CNN before the first Gulf War. And it was an opening in their Chicago bureau. And as it turns out, the correspondent who ended up taking that job was stationed in the Middle East for some time, right as the first Gulf War was breaking out. There was a little bit of, maybe I shouldn't have been so quick to say thanks but no thanks. Just to be on the just to be in the front row of such an historic moment in time. That's probably the, if there's a regret, and I'm not even sure I'd call it a regret, but that was probably one opportunity where I second guessed myself maybe a little bit, but it didn't last very long.
You mentioned historic moments in time. We're living through, obviously, those historic moments in time. And we're looking at, you know, a lot of, you know, racial confrontation going on in this country right now. You were in L.A. in 92 when the Rodney King verdict happened. You were there when the riots were going on. First part of that question is, why were you there at that point in time? And the second part of that question is, what was that like compared to where we are today?
April 29th, 1992. I know the date because it's my birthday. We were flying out to Los Angeles to cover a different story. For those who have been around here long enough, they might remember that in the early 90s, Kansas City was in the running for a final assembly plant for what was then Douglas Aircraft. Douglas Aircraft wanted to build a big jumbo jet, and they had plans on the table, and they were ready to go, and they were looking for a place to build it. And Kansas City was in the running for that plant. It would have meant thousands of high-paying jobs, and what we thought was maybe a level of economic stability. Of course, now that we know what we know years later, that probably wouldn't have been the case, but we didn't know that at the time. But going out to Los Angeles at that time, it was going to be our only opportunity to talk to the people, to the decision makers, to ask them questions about what they thought about the Kansas City bid. And there was, so they scheduled this meeting. And so as I'm getting on the plane, and a little bit about technology in local television news in 1992, we all had satellite capability. And KNBC belonged to this satellite cooperative of stations all over the country called CONUS. And we all had these big, extremely expensive, cumbersome satellite trucks that you could drive to places and broadcast from places that we never could before. And when we would go out of town, we would call whoever the CONUS affiliate was in that town and say, hey, can we use our truck rather than drive ours all the way out to Los Angeles? And so the CONUS affiliate out there is a major independent station in Los Angeles, KTLA Channel 5. And so we had made arrangements with KTLA to, this was going to be the way for me to get our material up on the bird and back down so people in Kansas City could see it. So the Rodney King trial was happening. They were knee deep in coverage. And so as I'm getting on a plane in Kansas City, we know the verdict has happened. And our last conversation with the people at Channel 5 in Los Angeles was, we'll do all we can to help you, but the verdict has just happened and we don't know what's going to happen tonight in our city. So if you want to go ahead and take a chance, by all means. And so we sort of rolled the dice and said, okay, we're going out. So I get on a plane knowing that the verdict has happened. And so 3 hours later, the plane I'm on, we're on final into LAX, and I look out the window and I see probably 10 really good sized fires burning. And it was at that moment I knew it's on. So I get off the plane, I quickly find a phone at LAX and call back to my desk in Kansas City, where the local time is somewhere after midnight. And I say, hey, I don't know what you guys are seeing back there, but there's a hell of a riot going on here. And they said, yeah, we know. Why don't you, for now, find your hotel and let's talk really early, first thing in the morning. And so we did. I was working with a freelance photographer in Los Angeles who I hadn't picked up yet, but was going to first thing in the morning. And so, long story short, make contact with the freelance photographer, talk to my people. Suddenly we know, we have a much better idea of what is going on in Los Angeles. And so we ended up spending a little bit of time going to Douglas Aircraft and trying to cover that part of the story. But we didn't spend a lot of time there. And so we went off and covered the riot. And this will sound funny to say, but it's the middle of the day in South Central Los Angeles on April 30th, 1992. And I'm with a freelance photographer who thankfully has a very good sense of Los Angeles and what it's all about and places to go and places to stay away from. He had been a veteran photographer in that market for many, many years. And so I took advantage of that experience. But we kind of find ourselves in the middle of it. And picture for a moment a street with all kinds of small businesses on either side of it, okay? And people are just literally walking in and out of these businesses, whether it's a barber shop, whether it's something akin to like a Dollar General today, something like a convenience store that what we would find today, any kind of store that you can imagine, people were walking in and out of, and they would walk in with nothing and walk out with as much as they could carry. And there weren't a lot of police officers around to put a stop to that because of the size of Los Angeles that was kind of up for grabs at that time. The National Guard had been called out, but there were problems getting them mobilized because they didn't have the right equipment, and they ended up having to go to another state. And it just took a long time for the National Guard to get on the ground in South Central Los Angeles. And it wasn't until the National Guard got there and they were able to maintain that what was roughly about a 20-25 square block perimeter. Once they were able to establish that, then the LAPD could go in and clean things up. But there were just far too many people taking advantage of this situation than there were cops. And so we're looking at all of, we're looking at a part of a big city that is, again, up for grabs. And we're looking for a safe place to record some really dangerous stuff. And there were all kinds of people had all kinds of weapons. We had a couple of those weapons pointed at us at a couple of moments.
What do you do in that situation when somebody's pointing a gun at you?
You back off, you put your hands up and say, okay, we're out. And that's kind of what we did.
How scared were you?
It's the only time there are two times in my professional career that I worried about my safety, and that was one of them.
What was the other?
I was a radio reporter in the Quad Cities. It was my first job. It was late at night. There was a big UAW strike at a farm implement plant, and I happened to come across somebody who I think had probably had way, way, way too much to drink and was certainly angry about the situation and where the contract talks were going and probably about his own economic future, who pulled a knife on me. But that was probably the only other time. But LA was just a whole different deal. And so, you know, it was about a 36-hour day, as I recall, the LA riot. And to this day, words matter to me, as you know. I have been, I think, exceedingly careful in using the word riot to describe civil unrest. I didn't use the word riot when describing Ferguson, though there are probably people who would argue that what happened there certainly rises to that level. I certainly didn't use the word riot in describing what was happening here in Kansas City just a few weeks ago. I don't think it was anywhere close. To me, my bar between what's a riot and what's not, if it doesn't look like what I saw in L.A., in 92, it just doesn't rise to that level for me. But it was I've never seen anything like it. I hope to God I never see anything like it. It has taken that community decades to try to recover from it socially, economically. And here we are in 2020 still talking about the same issues. That's a really sad thing to say.
Did you think we would be? Did you think that would start the healing process back in 1992? Because I really don't feel like it has. I mean, and I'm with you. It's 2020. We shouldn't be having conversations because we shouldn't have discrimination in this country right now.
I thought the LA riot, the South Central riot in 92 was a bottom. Then again, you know, the Watts riots in the 60s were probably seen as a bottom. The riots that followed the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 68 were probably seen as a bottom. You know, we've been here before. And the fact that we're still here in 2020 is a tragedy on so many levels. And I guess I'm one of those people who, like you, I just would have thought we would have been farther down the road than we are. And that's really sad.
Do you think this is the bottom and now we start going up? Like, do you think this is the moment in time where everybody finally realizes this has been pretty messed up? We've been doing it wrong and we right ourselves and we right the situation?
This does feel different. This feels different than 68. This feels different than 92. This does feel different. And I don't know that I can put my finger on why, but it does. It gives me hope that somehow, some way, there's going to be real change on a lot of levels. Things that should have happened a long time ago. We'll see. We've all been down this road before, and we've all seen what's happened and have been disappointed. But there's, with so much at stake, you got to keep trying. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's because we're in Kansas City and we're not in Minneapolis, or we're not in Atlanta, or we're not in some of the other cities where there have been far greater problems. I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Let's put it that way.
When we're sitting here and you're covering these stories, and like when you're covering, I'll just say 2020, right? When you're covering 2020 and you're a news guy, do you ever look in the mirror and go, man, I should have stayed in sports and should have followed that dream?
Well, no, I don't know about that. For those who don't know, it all started for me at a 1,000-watt radio station in Moline, Illinois. How many times have you heard that? I was still a senior in high school when I got my job, first job reading weekend news on that radio station. But that radio station had, they had just won a National Headliners Award. It was a 6-person full-time newsroom in a city of 45,000 people, in a metropolitan area of about 350,000 people. So that's pretty tough to find one of those today. But they had just won a National Headliners Award, and again, they were really good people, and this will sound familiar. Once again, I walk into a room with some seasoned professionals. I always knew this is what I wanted to do. And I thought, if I just kept my mouth shut and watched how these people work, I might learn something. For those who don't know, my father was a television anchor up in the Quad Cities for 35 years. And so growing up kind of in the business and being around newsrooms were never places that were intimidating to me and were always places that I treated with respect. But again, I'm walking into a room with people who know what they're doing, and I want to be like them. And so the best way to get from point A to point B at a moment like this is shut up and watch how they work, and hopefully you learn something.
Mm-hmm. And did you learn something? News was the right route. Sports is not the way to go.
Yeah, I no regrets there, though. Sports was – I did a lot of sports at that radio station. And in fact, there was 1 year, as it took me 5.5 years to get out of college. And one of the reasons why is there was 1 year that was kind of thrown away, but it was a wonderful experience. The radio station that I worked at had just won a contract to broadcast University of Iowa basketball home and away. And there were 5 stations originating Iowa basketball at the time. We happened to be one of them. It's far different now, but, the play-by-play guy at the time is the longtime play-by-play voice of the Arizona Diamondbacks on radio, Greg Schulte. And so Greg and I did Iowa basketball home and away. And your typical Big Ten road trip in the 1979-80 season involved Thursday-Saturday games. So you're leaving town Wednesday, and you're not getting back until either late Saturday night or early Sunday morning. So there were an awful lot of classes I missed. But Greg obviously did play-by-play. I did pregame, halftime, and post. And it was so much fun. Lute Olson was the head coach of the Hawkeyes at the time. They went to the Final Four. It was Ronnie Lester's team. It was so much fun. And Iowa City is about an hour's drive from the Quad Cities, so real close. I had a ball. I'm not kidding. It was more fun. It sure be doing high school basketball and football games. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay?
Much nicer digs, much nicer surroundings. In many respects, it was kind of the big time, at least the way I saw it at that time. It was so much fun. But as we got later, deeper into that season, I ended up having to leave that broadcast team because the station was running into some financial problems. This was a blessing, believe me. Because I was missing so much school. And I was working at the radio station, but going to college at the time, it was always my top priority to get a degree. And I knew that the road that I was on, missing all of this class and all of this time and all of this study time, I knew it wasn't going to happen. And so the fact that it ended the way it did was a real blessing for me, because I got kind of recentered and back on the path that I always wanted to be on originally anyway.
And I think, you know, sports to me, and we're in this time now of what's a necessary business and all this kind of stuff. And for me, sports is a necessary business because of the way it's a mentally cleansing type of deal. And I think everybody needs to focus on their mental health now more so maybe than ever. But when a team wins, the kind of effect that it has on a community is something like we've never seen before. I mean, I go back to 14 and 15 with the Royals and not just them winning a championship, I think we changed as a city when the Royals won. We grew up, we became better, we believed in ourselves, our mental health got better. I think we advanced as a town when the Royals won. Then capped that off with the Chiefs winning the Super Bowl. And I don't think we've been able to really take advantage of that because of the quarantine and the pandemic. But I think sports has such an effect on the mental state of a town. When your team is doing well, man, everybody's feeling good.
Listen, I'll go back to the World Series championship of 1985. The memory and the feeling of that championship lasted in this city probably far longer than it should have. Mm-hmm. And I think the memories of 85 really got us through as a sports town some really, really awful years of baseball, as you well know.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, let's face it, the Royals, there were a lot of years where the Royals were just weren't very good.
Right.
And interest in the team was not as high as it is. But sports, as you well know, Bob, I mean, it has this innate ability when things are going right and your team is winning, it makes an entire city feel better about themselves. And I think that's especially important in Kansas City's case because, and other people have said this, and I've said this for years, and for whatever reason, I think Kansas City has an odd, almost inferiority complex about itself. That while we love living here, we on some level just don't quite feel like we rise to the level of, say, a Minneapolis or a Denver or even St. Louis. Which I think it's an incorrect view, but I think a lot of us have it. And again, I'm not, maybe it's because it's the Midwest and Kansas Cityans, I think, like they do probably in a lot of other communities, this has a very, while it's a big city, but it has a small town feel to it. Maybe that's part of it, I don't know. But when your team wins a championship, man, you just feel like you're on top of the world, and you feel we now have something that New York doesn't have, or Chicago doesn't have, or St. Louis doesn't have, as we all felt in 85. And sports has that way. It just does. And we're never going to forget 85. We're never going to forget 2014 and 2015. And we're sure as hell never going to forget the Super Bowl championship in Miami. And you're absolutely right. The pandemic has robbed us of that sort of really good feeling that should have come with a moment like that. And it's too bad. On the other hand, I can't wait for football to start again, because if anybody's had a better off season than the Kansas City Chiefs, they've signed Mahomes, they've signed Chris Jones. You know, the cap is under control. They have all these starters coming back. Hashtag run it back. I'm on board. I am totally on board with this team.
Is there anything that you can even think is a close second when it comes to uniting people other than sports?
Oh. Maybe I think of a tragedy like 9/11.
Yeah.
That certainly reunited us in ways that we never imagined. But probably not, no. Yeah, I remember being at the, just speaking of 9/11, I don't know why I'm thinking of it. This just popped in my head. The first NFL game, one of the first NFL games that followed 9/11 was at Arrowhead.
Best sporting event I've ever been to.
When the Giants came to town, and I we were season ticket holders at the time, and we weren't going to miss that game. And the feeling in the stands, yeah, we wanted the Chiefs to win that day, but if they hadn't, it would have been okay. But I think that was a Sunday that it gave Kansas Cityans a chance to reach out to people in New York and say, we love you, we care, we're all on the same team. And there haven't been a lot of moments like that where so many people come together and are all on the same page. And but for Kansas City, that was a chance to do that and to send that message, not just to Kansas City, but to the rest of the country, that we are all one. I don't know that we've ever had another moment like that since.
No.
It was sure pretty cool at the time.
It really was. I remember my dad and his friends flew in from New Jersey for that game. They were coming out anyway. It just happened to be that game after 9/11. And everybody in the parking lot coming up to him in his Giants jersey, hugging him. And, you know, we're here with you. Like, it was really a special moment that, you know, I get goosebumps talking about it because it was just there's not much more you can say than it was a special moment. And if you were there, you remember that day vividly, you know?
We'll never forget it.
Yep. No. All right. So one of the rules in journalism is, you know, report the story, don't be the story. But you actually became the story in 2003 with the tornadoes up north. Your house, boom, destroyed. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I'm still amazed that we walked away from an F4 tornado. Because at the time, on the Fujita scale at the time, an F4 was a storm that packed winds of between 205 and 250 miles an hour. You just don't get a chance to walk away from an F4. I'm sorry, you just don't. And so while that day I lost a house and almost a family, we never had to deal with a funeral. And if you put it in that context, the rest of the stuff is really pretty insignificant. But that was a time where we had 12 people in our house when it hit. And this is up in the newer part, what was then the newer part of the Carriage Hill Estates area in Kansas City North. And I was with my then father-in-law, whose house was about three blocks away on the Gladstone side of Carriage Hill Estates. And it was a birthday party for him and me. And we had these inch thick butterfly pork chops stacked on a plate ready to go on the grill. But we were short on steak knives. And so he and I went to his house to go get steak knives. And the weather was coming, straight line winds, rain, like it's crazy. And I'm in my SUV in his driveway. He's trying to lock his front door. We have the steak knives. And I will never forget, for as long as I live, looking to my right, which was west on what is Northeast 63rd Street on the Gladstone side. And at the end of the street, there was this enormous gray charcoal wall. And our tornado, it wasn't this sort of well-defined funnel that you see on TV. The base of this thing was enormous. And I saw this wall. And it's a feeling that is hard to describe, but it just, at that moment, I said to myself, oh my God, it's here. And we had been watching the tornado's progress all day long on TV, Johnny Rowland's up on News Chapter 9, but you never think it's going to happen to you. You never think it's going to happen to you. And we never thought it was going to happen to us. So I looked at Daryl, he looked at me, and he went from trying to lock his front door to quickly unlocking it, and we went down into his basement, and moments after that, the tornado hit. His house took a hit, a pretty good one, but it was still standing. The the tornado hitting that area, and I've gone back and forth in my head about the length of time, noise like you can't believe. There were all kinds of things hitting the house, all kinds of trees and you name it. It probably lasted a good 30 seconds. And so the storm passes. We come up, take a look outside, and there's damage to be seen. There's windows out and garage doors down and mature trees everywhere in the street. That part of the neighborhood took a hit, but all in all, not bad. I've seen worse. I've covered worse. Never mind the fact that you go a half block in any direction and it's devastation, but I couldn't see that at that moment. So I get on my cell phone and I'm trying to call home, and I get one of those rapid, bah, 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 one of those things. And I'm thinking, well, the cell towers are down. My view of the tornado at that moment is, while it's not good, but I've seen worse. And everybody's coming up from their basements. And so it looks as if everybody survives. It took probably 10, 15 minutes before one of the people at our party comes running up the street. And don't forget, there are mature trees in the street, so we can't go anywhere. One of the people at our party comes running up to us, all out of breath, and this is all he says. Everybody's okay, but your house is gone. And so at that moment, I start running. And so I run up Northeast 63rd Street, hang a left, then a right, and then up the hill. And then it dawns on me what has happened. When I got to the end of Northeast 63rd Street, to the newer part of Carriage Hill Estates at the time, then it hit me. Then it was like, oh my God, this was the real deal. And so I had the benefit of knowing that everybody at our house was okay. Kids, wife, in-laws, sisters-in-laws, significant others. But my wife at the time, she has a far different take on that moment, because she was convinced that her husband and her father might well be gone. So I get to the house and we make connections and we make sure that everybody's okay. We confirm that. And then I and another guy start going kind of house to house down the street just to see. I wasn't sure what we were going to see and was fearing the worst. For instance, the house across the street from ours was literally blown off its foundation. All that remained was this concrete slab that a house moments earlier stood. So we went from house to house just to try and find anybody. And as I say, the fact that no one in our neighborhood lost their lives at a moment like that, I just think is crazy. Absolutely crazy. But it happened. And it changed me in ways that I would never have imagined at the time. The one thing that I wish someone would have told me that night, and going through one of these things, you have a million and one things going on in your head. You are thankful for the fact that you're there. You're thankful for the fact that your family is alive. You're thankful for the fact that your friends are all okay, your neighbors. But then comes this moment of, well, where do we go from here? We had insurance, but I couldn't tell you at that time what was in the policy or how the process worked, or I had no clue. And I'll never forget one of the few things, worthwhile things that I did that moment was, so I tried to call my insurance agent, and I knew he had other clients in our neighborhood. And this is on a Sunday late in the day. And I'm thinking, well, you know, Carlos has other clients. Maybe he's gone into the office. So I call the office. Nobody there. I get the voicemail and the 1-800 number for our insurance company. So I call the 1-800 number for the insurance company. And a nice person answers the phone and says, hello, how can I help you? And at that moment, I didn't even know what to say. I just kind of blurted out and said, we just had a tornado. And the person who took the call was very nice. She said, is everybody okay? And I said, yeah, we're all here. Everybody's fine. And then her next question was, what's your policy number? which I didn't have an answer for, you know? And so I wasn't of much help to her at that moment. And then hung up 20 minutes later, an adjuster called and said, listen, we know what's happened. We're on it. We're pulling adjusters from all over the Midwest. And I remember asking him, what do I do now? And all he said was just take care of your family. And I said, okay, I think I can do that. But the one thing that I wish someone would have told me that night, with a million and one things going on in your head and none of them are good, I wish someone had put their arm around me and said, it's going to be okay. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next week. It's not going to be a month from now, but it's going to be okay. And in the tornadoes that I have covered since ours, I was in Joplin that night. I was in Jefferson City last year. I've covered three or four. Joplin was by far the biggest. The people who have been nice enough to share their stories with us, I've always taken a moment afterwards and put my arm around them and say, you're going to be okay. I know what you're going through, and, you know, it's going to be okay. You need to do some things first, like catch your breath, grab a piece of paper and a pencil and figure out, okay, we need to do this tomorrow. We need to do this the next day. We need to do this the day after that, whether it's finding a place to live or shopping for clothes or trying to figure out where you can store stuff, how you're going to move it. Whatever, the list is long, but you need a plan. And the only way you're going to do that is if you need to stop the world for a minute and sit down and say, okay, what's our next move? Which is a really hard thing to do at a time like this when you pretty much lost. We didn't lose everything, but it was pretty close. And, you know, for somebody who has been in daily journalism for as long as I've been in, even at that time, and I've covered many tornadoes before, but until it happens to you, you don't have a clue. I am here to tell you, I didn't have a clue. But I think it is certainly it's helped my reporting when it comes to an event like this, having been through it. And so it happened May 4th, 2003. We were back in what was our rebuilt house the week before Thanksgiving. And I'm going to tell you something. That Christmas was the best ever, because it was an important milestone. We had a huge party in our neighborhood the year after, the one-year anniversary of our tornado, and we shut down the street and cook steaks. It was one of the best parties I've ever been to, because it was, for a lot of us, the finish line. We'd finally made it. We'd finally gotten to something really, really close to what we had before. And at a moment when we never thought that might be possible, but we'd made it.
Yeah.
And, like I said, it was the best party ever.
So was the best moment of your career interrupting Bill Clinton? Was it being on Oprah? Was it interviewing Obama? Was it having a beer dumped on your head at a bar on St. Patrick's Day? Where do you rank all those?
They were all moments, you know. They were all moments. Which one do you want to hear first?
I love the Bill Clinton story. I think that one to me. And then I want to hear the St. Patty's Day beer story, because I've never heard you get dumped on.
Yeah, I was at a bar in and that part of this is our fault, because you never want to put a live camera in a bar on the night of St. Patrick. What the hell were we? It was a place in Johnson County, and I've tried to put that moment out of my mind. It was a 10 o'clock live shot, and somebody dumped a beer on my head, and I just carried on. That's what you do. I mean, it's not like you could. It's not like you could stop the you couldn't stop a moment in live television and, you know, go after this guy,
right?
The President Clinton story. Long story short, he came to Kansas City to address the Southern Governors Association at what was then the Ritz-Carlton, which is now the Intercontinental on the Plaza, in the ballroom downstairs, which is not a terribly big ballroom by Kansas City hotel ballroom standards, but a nice place, no doubt. And so it was a noon speech, and our plan was we were going to carry a little bit of the president's address right off the top at noon, and then we were going to get back to regular programming, because at the time ABC ran a soap opera called All My Children, which was extremely popular, especially in this market. And if you're going to interrupt All My Children, it better be for a better reason than a presidential address in your city. And so so anyway, I had my back to the president, and to this day, I still felt like I was talking in such a hushed tone that I wasn't going to interrupt anyone, including the president of the United States. But apparently I was a little loud, or louder than I should have been. I have my back to the president. I have a thing in my ear. I'm focused on what I'm trying to do. And so as I'm talking to our audience on Channel 9, live at 12 noon, the president of the United States stops his speech, points to the back of the room at me and says, "Does that guy back there want to give a speech?" And the whole room just lit up, just laughter like you couldn't believe. And the President Clinton, to his credit, seizing the moment, "We can't both talk at the same time." So he got another laugh. And so I was done. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know what had happened until the end of the speech, when I was surrounded by three Secret Service agents wanting to look at my credentials. They didn't tell me what had happened. They just wanted to know who I was. And so at that moment, I'm thinking, okay, something's happened here. Still didn't know. And then moments later, was surrounded by four or five members of the White House press corps. And they're all asking questions about this interruption in the speech. And it was at that moment I realized, oh, geez, that was me. And I remember turning to my right, and Steve Kraske, who was a longtime political reporter, great guy, Kansas City Star, one of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. And I remember asking Steve, who doesn't have a bad word to say about anybody. And I remember asking Steve, "Was I that loud?" And Steve said, "Yeah." So at that moment, I knew I had to make an apology. And I was anchoring our 5 o'clock broadcast at the time. And so I called into the newsroom, and they were watching the speech on a clean feed, meaning that all they saw was the president. They didn't see anything else in the room. One camera on the president, that's all they saw. And so I remember telling my producer, "Hey, that moment where the president was interrupted in his speech," she says, "Yeah." And I said, "That was me." And she said, "No." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Do me a favor. Give me like 90 seconds at the end of the 5 o'clock, and I'll issue an apology." I just felt like it was something that, A, I needed to kind of try and get out in front of. Social media hadn't happened. God forbid, if that same thing had happened during social media, in the time of social media, it would have been difficult. But there was no social media at the time, but the word was spreading around town. And so my first instinct was, we need to get out in front of this. We need to apologize and move on. So I wrote the apology. I walked it into my news director, who at the time was a guy named Brian Bracco. Wonderful man. And
you forgot Brian, legendary Brian Bracco.
Met the legendary Brian Bracco, who was one of the top local news executives in the country before his retirement a few years ago after president, general manager over at KSHB. So I wrote the apology, walked it into Brian. He still wasn't aware of what had happened. So I told him, and he said, "Okay." And I said, I want to make this apology. And he said, "Fine." I said, "I've written it. Take a look." He said, "Okay, this looks good. Fine. Everything's fine." So we get to 5 o'clock. I read the apology. Everything's fine. Come out of the studio into the newsroom. Brian says, "Hey, can we do that apology again at 6? We had gotten our share of nasty phone calls, as it turns out, throughout the afternoon. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but we had, again, the word was getting around town. people took it as disrespectful, and they wanted to make sure that we heard what they had to say about it. So we went ahead and we did the apology again at 6 o'clock, and then Good Morning America called, and there were a couple of other shows that called, and they wanted me to come on the air and talk about that moment. And I said to my boss, do I have to do this? And Brian said, no, not it's, he says, it's up to you. He says, I wouldn't do it if I were you, but that's up to you. And so I politely said no, even to GMA, same network. And then Oprah called, or the Oprah show called. It wasn't Oprah, but it was the show. And at the time, the Oprah Winfrey show was at 4 o'clock, and stations like ours paid her a lot of money to what was for an extremely successful show to build a large lead-in for our early local news, which was a newscast that I anchored. And so the Oprah Winfrey show calls and said, "Hey, can you come out to Chicago and talk about this moment?" And that was a hard one to say no to because of the fact of what I just explained. So I went out to Chicago, did the Oprah show. Actually, it was the second time I had been on Oprah. The first time was for. It was Kelly Ackerman, who I was anchoring the 5 o'clock with at the time. We were in Chicago on the Oprah show on the day of the Oklahoma City bombing. We were there to do another show, but then Oklahoma City happened. And the Oprah Winfrey show at the time was out of Chicago, and they would do two shows. The show that they did at 9 o'clock in the morning during the week was seen live in Chicago on WLS TV channel 7 up there. But then they would do another show that would start at about noon, which was the show that they, there was much more production involved. And they were both shows that got sent out to the rest of the country. But so we, Kelly and I, we go to Chicago to do a show on, Oprah wanted to do the show on organizing. If you looked in our newsroom, my desk was clean and Kelly's was a mess. And so she was going to bring in this this organizing expert to try and straighten us out, okay? And then, then Oklahoma City happened. Hang on just a sec. We're recording something here. You can tell I'm home, can't you?
Yeah. It's normal now, though, Chris. Nobody cares.
So anyway, so we go to Chicago, and then... so we're sitting in the studio. It's before the 9 o'clock show, which again was seen live in Chicago, but sent out to the rest of the country. And Oprah starts the show by saying, "Hey, Oklahoma City's happened. We need to talk about Oklahoma City." And so Kelly and I are sitting in the green room thinking, there's no way that they're going to try and do this show on, organizing your closet or your desk or whatever when, this Oklahoma City's happened. So we're sitting in the green room, and about 40 minutes later, Oprah says, "Okay, well, we've talked about Oklahoma City. We're going to try and do the show that we originally had planned." And so suddenly a producer comes running in to Kelly and I and says, "Okay, let's go." So we wind through this hallway and we get out to the studio. And the Oprah show at the time, there were an awful lot of guests who were like in the front row. And I just kind of instinctively thought, well, I'm going to be in that front row. I'm going to be in the audience, okay? And I'm starting to walk this way, and the producer says, no, you're on home base. That's what they called it, home base. So so we did the show, and it was fine. And then, I interrupt the president, and I come back for another shot on Oprah. It was me and about four or five other local television reporters who had embarrassing moments in their careers. And mine was certainly one of them. And I'll never forget, and this was one of those shows that they taped. It wasn't seen live in Chicago. And I'll never forget, Oprah said, in introducing me, "Chris Katz from KNBC TV in Kansas." And I'm like, oh, I hate it when they do that. I hate it when they do that. Mm-hmm. And so we get into a break, and I whispered into Oprah's ear. I said, "Listen, your introduction It's KNBC TV in Kansas City, not Kansas. And she kind of paused and whispered, "Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right." And so I went to one of the producers. I said, "Can we do this again?" I said, "It's okay. We'll fix it in post-op." So, oh, okay. Well, so anyway, so I called Oprah on mispronouncing Kansas City. She's done okay since then, though.
She's been all right. Yeah, I think so. So what's next now for you? I mean, you've been on Oprah. You've interviewed presidents. You've won Emmy Awards. World Series, Super Bowls. What's next?
I want to do another Super Bowl. I was in Miami for this one. Laura Moritz was down earlier in the week. I didn't get there until Friday. I want to do another Super Bowl. I think we should make plans for Tampa in February of next year. I think this team is set up for a long and glorious run. And, and let's hopefully, when we get to the other side of this pandemic, which we will, hopefully we'll have the kind of extended celebration that we were all robbed of this year. Mm-hmm. That would be cool. I'd like to see that. I really would.
What an amazing look back at the career of one of the greatest anchormen to have ever called Kansas City home. Chris Ketz has truly seen it all right here in our town, and there's no stopping him. 37 years in the books, maybe another 37 to go.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.